Welcome to Building Fortunes Radio. Make sure you check us out at buildingfortunesradio.com. Along with our marketing partners, we're here to help our PM Marketing Network Lead customers build their businesses and make the world a better place. At Building Fortunes, we know how much your business means to you and the people important to you. So spread the word, tell a friend, join our newsletter, and go make a difference in your world. Now on to our show with your host, Peter Mingles.
Hello, everyone. Peter Mingles here. You're listening to us on Building Fortunes Radio. It's a Saturday night. It's 8:30 p.m. here on the eastern side, and it's less than that, or the next day, I guess, over where our guest host is. And I'm going to start off by just saying I'm going to keep my introduction really quick because Scott Johnson, this is his radio show, and he invited a special guest that we've had on a while back, and it's been a long time ago, and we kind of keep in touch in different and various ways. But I was thoroughly impressed with him. He's spoken at a lot of different places. He has opinions that are sometimes similar and different than mine in reference to some of the stuff that happens in the MLM world, and overall just a really good guy. So the reality is I'm very interested in hearing what he has to say about some of the topics that we're going to bring up, so I'm going to kind of step out of the way as fast as I can. But just a short introduction, Scott Johnson has had this radio show, I think it's been since 2015, I think, I'm not really sure, but it's been a long time. It started as a result of me having a radio show interview with Roger Van Vlissingen, who was somebody who was talking about Herbalife and Vima and other publicly traded companies, although Vima wasn't publicly traded at the time. Herbalife was being attacked, if you will, by the FTC. And we'll talk a little bit about FTC stuff as we get through this radio show, but Roger came on with his buddy E. Robert Smith, and E. Robert Smith wrote a book as well. And Scott Johnson called me back up after that radio show and said, you know, that was a nice radio show, but a lot of people aren't talking about something that's really big in the MLM industry, and hardly anybody talks about it. And I said, what's that, Scott? And he said, the tools scam associated with MLM. So he's going to talk a little bit about the tool scam, but I said, you know, let's do some radio shows on this. And this has turned into a lot more than just the Amway tool scam. It's turned into a lot of conversations about the industry, and you'll hear a lot if you listen to our radio show. And I promise you, if you listen to enough shows that Scott and I do and then plug in, Dave is a gentleman you can plug into as well with his views on MLM, I'll share with you. You'll have enough information about MLM to be able to make your way through this industry however you choose. Whether you're pro or you're minus or pro or anti, it doesn't really matter at this point. We're having conversations, and I think that's healthy for the whole way this thing works. So, Scott Johnson, thanks for being here on your own radio show.
Hey, Peter, thanks. Yeah, you mentioned something really important there, and that is on our show, we don't have to have agreement. I value the diversity of ideas, and I don't shut down people that just happen to have different ideas, because I think it helps both sides learn things. If you're all singing the same tune, to me, you're just not making any progress. You're not exploring. You're not finding out new things, and you're probably not going as far as you could if you had someone with a differing view to really hash out, you know, what you think, number one, and then maybe what they or others think, number two. So I've always been in favor of diversity of ideas, and it's really in our Constitution, right, the First Amendment, freedom of speech. And I feel very strongly that that is one of the things that made the United States the preeminent country in the world, is we can speak our minds in most cases. Of course, there's exceptions, and there's also, you know, places like YouTube and other social media outlets that think that they know better what free speech is, and since they're a private platform, they're allowed to do that because the First Amendment really applies to governments. However, I think in the spirit of free speech, it would be better if YouTube opened up, but again, it's their business, so they can do what they want. And you're right, we did start in 2015. It was the year before the settlements with Herbalife and Vima with the FTC, and the main thing that came out of those two settlements, in my mind, was the fact that the FTC negotiated with them that they would have at least about half of their sales going to customers, people who were not part of the MLM compensation plan, to prevent them from being an illegal pyramid. Now, we've gotten some mixed signals recently, and we'll talk about that with Dave a little bit. I think Dave's been on at least twice. Dave, I don't know if you recall how many times you've been on, but I think it's been at least twice. And, you know, we are glad to have you back for sure. So the lack of retail sales is what constitutes an illegal pyramid. You know, some people go around saying, well, it's the multiple levels, or we have products, so we can't be an illegal pyramid. And those are just not right. The FTC has been successful with several companies. I wish they would go across the industry. They have had success with several companies, and it normally comes down to lack of retail sales. That's the bottom line, and that's why I harp on that. Now, there's no law that says 50% is the minimum. I think there should be a law that defines the minimum, whether it's 50-50 or, you know, maybe twice as much, which would be, you know, 67-33. You can do things different ways. I think a good starting point would be 50-50. But anyway, that's the problem that I think is across the board in MLM. And we found out something recently that was interesting in the insurance MLM arena. It looks like, at least from one person's experience, I think it was our guest last week or week before, Peter, who came in and talked a little bit about the insurance industry. Now, his experience is a little dated, and so I wouldn't make any final conclusions based on that, but it was interesting that he said that in the insurance, I think it was Primerica was the company he was in, there really is a big emphasis on recruiting versus selling, which surprised me. We've talked about that before. So that's a data point. The other big thing, which is how we got started, Peter, was the Amway Tool Scam. That's the name that I've given it. This is where the upper-level distributors in Amway, they call them IBOs now, independent business owners, they sell tools. And these things are anything from meeting tickets for various size meetings, to books, to recordings, to phone apps, to voicemail, to website access. There's all kinds of things that they sell under the pretense of training and motivating their downline, which I think the content does a decent job of. I don't agree with everything I've ever heard on a tool or from stage, but I'm sure there's not a person on this planet that I agree with everything. And so that doesn't bother me that it doesn't line up exactly with my direction. The problem with the tool scam isn't the information, in my view. It's also not making money. I don't have a problem with people making money. But when you lie by omission, that's where most of your money comes from, and you mislead your downline, you essentially lie by not saying, oh, yeah, most of my money comes from the tools, then that's a problem. I think it's RICO fraud. I'm not a lawyer, but it's at least business fraud. If you say, hey, you know, I want you to get into business with me, but I'm not going to tell you the whole story. I'm going to tell you the part I want you to hear and not tell you the part I don't want you to hear. And that's what's happening with the Amway tool scam and other MLMs like Herbalife that have tool scams. Not all do, but the ones that do, particularly Amway, I think it's the one that's on steroids. It's the most profitable. And if you go on my Facebook page, it's facebook.com/ScottTexJohnson. It's ScottTexJohnson, all one word. And there's a lineup of links on the left-hand side of the page. One of those links is to Rumble. And a guy by the name of Joe Markowitz, who just finished a term as the IBO AI chairperson. I won't go into details of that, what that means. But he was a big kahuna in Amway, still is. And he talked about first year is going to be free for tools for new people. And on two different occasions on this 9-minute video, he stated that the sole reason, his word, the sole reason they have tools is to help the downline create a profitable and long-term business, which is an outright lie, obviously. If you're making most of your money from the tools and you're claiming that the sole reason that you have tools is to help people, that's a lie. And you'll find other things on my three websites. I have a YouTube link there. There's a link to an interesting Vimeo video that used to be on Rumble. I'm still working out with Rumble to see if I can get it back up again. But there's various things there, my phone number, my email, and I don't know if Dave knows this, but I did retire at the end of January, so now I've become much more dedicated to spreading what I think are the things that are wrong with MLMs. To me, it's not all the drama stuff that you see on YouTube. It's these very simple bottom line root cause issues, the tool scam and lack of retail sales. It all boils down to that. Everything else to me is a distraction. It takes away from focusing on stuff that's really legal versus illegal, or should be legal versus illegal. If the FTC can get off their rear ends, then I think we can make real change. So far, it's been all talk, and that's unfortunate. But anyway, we like to cover those things at the beginning of the shows for the new listeners so you can know where we're coming from, because we're not anti-MLM. We're also not pro-MLM. We're anti-MLM when it's done wrong. We're pro-MLM when it's done right. And our two major criteria, at least mine, are retail sales and tool scams. Those are the two biggies. I think you can fix every other issue out there with MLMs, and you won't make a dent in the problem. You fix these two things, and you'll probably fix at least 95% of the problem. Not that there aren't other issues. I'm not denying there's other issues. It's just that they're much more minor, and I think they would be much smaller if those two things I mentioned were fixed. But think about any business, even non-MLM business. There's no business out there that's perfect, because they're all run by humans, and there's no human that's perfect, so there's no business that's perfect. So I'm not looking for perfection. I'm just looking to get the big things out of the way. Then we can tackle the smaller things as they occur. But if we don't go after those two big things, I'm afraid we're just not going to get anywhere, and that's just where I come from. So anyway, Dave, welcome to the show again, and you're coming to us from Taiwan on the other side of the planet. And just, again, welcome to the show. And if you can, just introduce yourself again for the new listeners. Give them a little bit of background on your experience with MLM and how you got involved in the whole discussion. And then we can talk about a couple things that we wanted to talk about. So go right ahead, Dave.
Sure thing. Thank you, Scott, and thank you, Peter, for inviting me on again. My name is Dave Vaughn. I'm living in Taiwan currently. I'm teaching internationally, mostly in English, but next year I will be teaching an AP Econ course, so hopefully I can freshen my chops on that topic a little bit today, maybe. And in general, my experience with MLM has been from the external. I've never been involved in MLM myself. I was first introduced to sort of the angle of harm that can take place within MLM here in Taiwan. And when I moved to Iraq, I also saw a little bit of it taking place over there, but it was mostly in sort of retail settings. So it was shops that were popping up in malls and in some small retail locations, Avon, Mary Kay, that sort of thing. So I was talking to some people about their experiences in MLM, and it started to raise red flags for me in terms of how the incentive structures were designed in a way to create the ultimate harm that I was seeing taking place. And I wanted to dig into more of the data to get a better sense of how that was working and why it sort of devolved in that way. And of course, in exploring that, I was introduced to a number of platforms, including your own, and I reached out to those people and just started asking questions. And in that time, I've appeared on the MLM conference, which I believe is coming up again this year at the start of May. And I've also been a part of some of the blogs. I know some of those blogs have retired. I was on Ethan Vanderbilt's blog for a little bit, and he was active in the MLM space. So I'm happy to be on here today, and I think we're going to dive into some of the statements that were released in mid-March by Lois Griesman.
Yes. In fact, we talked about this briefly before the show. I've been itching to talk about these letters. We've had guests the last few weeks, and they were not guests who were real familiar, you know, with sort of the deep dive information like you are. And so I kind of held back talking about those letters. But, yeah, they floored me, both those letters. And Peter, I think you have a recording of an FTC announcement. It's about 3 minutes long to kind of give people some background information, because a lot of people that are listening may not be familiar with what we're talking about with these letters and the FTC and MLM and the DSA and the DSSRC, all these different alphabet soup organizations. And that would be a nice, I think, background for this discussion. If you can go ahead and play that, Peter, then we'll continue.
Absolutely. So this, just to give people a little bit of an insight, there was a recent announcement about some new FTC commissioners being appointed and maybe even some of their tenure being expanded. And this is a letter directly from the FTC. I took the disclaimer that they have down on the bottom, which is like a description of what the FTC is, and I just put it up on the top. And then I used some software that can read the text of the letter in a woman's voice, and you're going to hear it's going to be about 3 minutes. But just as a side note, a lot of people in the MLM world don't really know what the FTC does. So they handle acquisitions and mergers, whether they're good or not, and they handle a lot of deceptive advertising. And they're bigger than MLM, but they are obviously make a very big impact on MLM. So here we go with that quick thing. It's going to take about 3 minutes.
The Federal Trade Commission works to promote competition and protect and educate consumers. The FTC will never demand money, make threats, tell you to transfer money, or promise you a prize. You can learn more about consumer topics and report scams, fraud, and bad business practices online at reportfraud.ftc.gov. Follow the FTC on social media, read our blogs, and subscribe to press releases for the latest FTC news and resources. FTC Chair welcomes Ferguson and Holyoke as FTC Commissioners, congratulates Commissioner Slaughter on confirmation to another term. March 8, 2024. Federal Trade Commission Chair Lena M. Kahn today congratulated Andrew N. Ferguson and Melissa Holyoke on their confirmation to serve as FTC Commissioners and Commissioner Rebecca Kelly Slaughter on her confirmation to a second term. Congratulations to Andrew Ferguson and Melissa Holyoke on their confirmations, and to Commissioner Slaughter on her reconfirmation, said Chair Kahn. I look forward to welcoming Andrew and Melissa to the FTC as we work to vigorously protect Americans from unfair methods of competition and unfair and deceptive business practices. Ferguson and Holyoke were nominated on July 11, 2023 by President Biden to serve as FTC commissioners. Ferguson's term will end on September 25, 2030, and Holyoke's term will end September 25, 2025. Slaughter was renominated by Biden on February 13, 2023, and her term will end on September 25, 2029. Ferguson most recently served as Solicitor General of the Commonwealth of Virginia. Prior to that position, he served as Chief Counsel to U.S. Sen. Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the Republican leader, and as a Republican counsel on the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee. He also practiced law at several Washington, D.C. law firms. He earned his undergraduate degree and law degree from the University of Virginia. After law school, Ferguson clerked for Judge Karen L. Henderson on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit and U.S. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Holyoke most recently served as Solicitor General with the Utah Attorney General's Office. Before taking on that role, she served as President and General Counsel of Hamilton Lincoln Law Institute, a Washington, D.C.-based public interest law firm, and in other public interest attorney positions with the Competitive Enterprise Institute and the Center for Class Action Fairness. Holyoke earned her undergraduate degree and law degree from the University of Utah. Slaughter first joined the commission in May 2018 and served as its acting chair from January 2021 until June 2021. Previously, she served as chief counsel to U.S. Sen. Charles Schumer of New York, the Democratic leader, and as an associate in the Washington, D.C. office of Sidley Austin LLP. She earned her undergraduate degree and law degree from Yale University.
There you go, Scott.
All right. Thanks, Peter. Yeah, I'm sorry. I was thinking the recording was talking about the letters, but it was about these two new commissioners. But it does tie in. Let's talk about these two new commissioners. As background information, the reason that these two new commissioners are coming in is because the previous two commissioners, which were Republican commissioners, this is a political organization, and whoever's the party in power at the president level gets to have three of the five commissioners of their choice, and then the other two have to be at least Democrat or not Republicans, let's put it that way. They're usually Democrats. Now, with Biden in office, it's three Democrat and two Republican, but it's been only three Democrats for, I think it's been at least a year, maybe 2 years, with one of them that resigned. And the reason they resigned, even though it's always been a political organization and, you know, whoever's in power has the majority, as far as the FTC commissioners, they were just so frustrated by the lack of process that was going on with the Democrat chairperson over the FTC, that they just weren't doing the normal process of making decisions. They were just making quick unilateral decisions. Every vote was 3-2 with no discussion. So they were just ramrodding things through with the other commissioners basically looking like wall decorations. And so they said, hey, we're out of here. And so that's a little bit of background as far as why we have these two new commissioners. A couple things tickled me. I want to let Dave in here too real quick, but one of the things that was said early on, Peter, was the FTC will not demand money. And that's true. The FTC won't come to an individual and demand money. But until about, I think it's been 3 years now, about 3 years ago when there was a 9-0 Supreme Court ruling that the FTC had been overstepping their authority for the past 40 years, taking MLMs and other companies to court, doing what they call ex parte hearings, which means one-sided. You know, they go in there and tell the judge, hey, judge, this person or this organization is so bad, you know, we need to shut them down immediately, make sure we take all their money so they can't move it out of the country, and basically shut down the company without any pushback from the company or the individual side, which, of course, is a Fifth Amendment violation of due process. But the FTC has been getting away with it for literally 40 years. And ever since then, I think their behavior has been that they're just butthurt. They can't believe they lost that authority. They did, 9-0. And they're upset about it. And there's a couple other things too, but I want to let Dave in here because he's our guest. Dave, did you have any comments on the two new commissioners?
I will say so. Lena Khan, in terms of her role within the FTC, it's much more about the antitrust cases against big tech. Like, she is zoomed in on trying to address the issues with Meta, Facebook, Google, and Apple. And I think that a lot of her work with the FTC over her term has been bringing on staff members that are focused on that big project that she has. So MLM, it seems to be on a back burner in many regards. I think Ravi Chopra, who has moved over to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, I believe is CFPB, he seemed to be the one that was sort of more aware of the consumer concerns that were arising within MLM, but with him moving over there, and it being more of a banking oversight group, he hasn't really been able to shift the FTC focus back to some of these consumer concerns. And I would say Slaughter was the only one who was really kind of somewhat aware, especially of the names that were mentioned. The one concern that I would say about Melissa is that she's coming from Utah. She's worked in consumer protection before, but she has nothing that I found that really related to any redress that she did on behalf of individuals that were affected by MLMs. And being in Utah on a per capita basis, you would assume that maybe there would at least be some reports of people looking for some redress. So that's the one thing that I would note about the new commissioners.
Yeah, and just to, because I agree with everything you said, just to put a point on it, Utah is really the mecca of MLM company headquarters. I mean, I've never done a count of it, but I would guess that maybe a pretty clear majority of MLMs are based in Utah. And it really is, you know, the center of the universe, as it were, as far as the number of MLMs. Now, there's some very large MLMs that are not located in Utah. Amway's one of them. They're in Michigan. Herbalife is another one. They're in Los Angeles. But when you talk about the number of MLMs, I mean, it's just a breeding ground. Now, where I live in Texas, it's also a pretty large MLM universe, I guess you could say. There's organizations that are based in Texas that are kind of, I wouldn't call them lobbyists, like the DSA, the Direct Selling Association, but you have like Direct Selling News and a couple of other sort of MLM representative companies that are based here in Texas, as well as several MLMs also. So just to give people an idea of the landscape of MLMs, and I would share the concern that she might be kind of sympathetic to MLMs with all of that business that's in Utah. That would be certainly something I would be concerned about. It would be interesting to talk with her sometime and say, hey, what do you know about MLMs? Because if she doesn't know anything and she came from Utah, that would be concerning. I also noticed that neither of the commissioners are from Ivy League schools, right? The one fellow is from Virginia and she's from Utah, which I think is unusual. I think most of the at least recent FTC commissioners have been Ivy League schools, which I don't necessarily have a ton of respect for. I think they're kind of a closed system and, you know, it's the good old boy thing. So in a way, I think that's a good thing. But I'm concerned that they're going to be marginalized. And we'll have to see what happens in the election in November to see if the parties change, because that will change things. There will be at least one of those Democrat commissioners out of a job and then a new Republican commissioner put in place. So, you know, we'll see what happens. It all depends on the election. So, Peter, did you have anything else that you wanted to mention about those two commissioners? I guess I have one more thing. The one more thing I wanted to mention was one of the commissioners that quit, I think, 2 or 3 years ago. And I'm trying to remember his name. I don't recall his name, but he... Noah Phillips, yes. He actually spoke at, I think it was the second, maybe the first MLM conference. If you go to MLMconference.com, like you mentioned earlier, Dave, it's coming up, I think it's May 2nd and 3rd. And you can see the past conferences. They have them on video. And you can see Commissioner Phillips' comments, and it was the first time that I can recall that a commissioner, actually anybody in the FTC, said anything about overhead costs. Now, I call overhead costs both legitimate and illegitimate because I expect to have to pay to put gas in my tank to go show somebody the marketing plan, right? I was in Amway for a dozen years, so I don't expect that to be paid for by somebody else. That's my business. That's my overhead, and I accept that. However, these thousands of dollars a year spent on tools is a whole different story. Now, he was more focused on the overhead costs I'm focused on both the overhead costs to the 99% of the IBOs that are paying into it, but I'm also interested, very interested, in the amount of profit that's being made by the top tier, you know, the top of the, I call them the scum layer, the scum at the top. They're making multiple times more from the tools compared to Amway. And I think often, in fact, I think it's even usually, the pin that's being worn by these people, they did attain it one time, but then they did not maintain it. And can you imagine, for example, a diamond in Amway having to go back to get a job? If there wasn't that tool money there, I think that would happen very frequently. And therefore, it's a big lie. It just sort of amplifies the lie. Not only are they making the money, but if they were not making that money from the tools, they would have to go get a job. And that would totally change the dynamics of Amway and other MLMs like Herbalife that have tool scams, because they could no longer show the lifestyle in an honest manner. They would have to, you know, they would just have to go back and get a job. And then, you know, it's like the Wizard of Oz. You pull the curtain back, see the man behind the curtain. I wouldn't mind if they kept the same tool profit as long as they're honest about it. But I think there's a reason they're not honest about it. I think they know most people would quit if they found out that most of the money comes from tools that they are paying into. That's really the rub there. But anyway,
Scott, just a short tangent on that part. It was something that I think Sean Munger, who has done, I guess, two videos now on some of the matters related to MLM. He did one on the Amway tool scam, which I think he also did an extra bonus video on, where he shared one of the recordings. And he recently did one on Costcott Interplanetary and Glenn Turner. So his unpacking of that, I think that he alluded to this, but he didn't really have a defined answer, and I don't know if you do as well, but within the tool profit system, is that a range in the sense that, like, you have a certain percentage of that tool profit going to the ones on the bottom, and that percentage increases all the way up to the top, or is it allocated differently? Are you aware of how that profit gets distributed amongst the line of sponsorship or line of affiliation in Amway?
Yes. And by the way, we had Sean Munger as a guest on here a year or so ago after he did that first video. I reached out to him again because I would love to have that Costcott discussion with him as well. But those are two excellent videos that he did. Now, he's more of a historian, so he doesn't do things that are recent. He does things that are at least 20 years ago. 30 would be preferable to him. I think he wants to let things kind of settle out, because that's the nature of history, is, you know, you can't really get an accurate picture immediately. You have to let things simmer a little bit. But to answer your question, it varies on the organization. I know that Orrin Woodward, he had the organization called Team, and he, on his blog after he got kicked out, made a statement that his Emeralds and above made 4 to 5 times more from the tools as they did compared to their Amway money. We had a recent guest on here, I guess, what, Peter, 2 or 3 weeks ago, a woman by the name of Dee. And that's not her real name, but that's the name that she wanted us to use on the show. And she was actually in LTD as a diamond. LTD is another organization, Leadership Team Development, led by Larry Winters. And she told us, I think it was on the show, Peter, but I've had some phone discussions with her too, and she told me that it's a little bit different in LTD. Larry Winters wanted the Emeralds to stay hungry, okay? And so they might make 50% compared to what they make from Amway. So let's say they make 100,000, just to keep the numbers easy. 100,000 from Amway, they would make 50,000 from the tools for LTD. And then when you get up into the diamond level, obviously there's a whole lot more money left over that you're not paying out to the emeralds. And there's generally a whole lot more emeralds than there are diamonds. And so it gets pretty lucrative in LTD. You know, you can do the numbers in your head, just estimating. Now, we also found out recently, I think it was through D, that the whole accreditation thing that Amway did many years ago, it's been probably about 20 years ago now, and the idea was to try to get a handle on some of the extreme content that was in the tools. And so the other thing that they were trying to do is get rid of the good old boy system, because what would happen was there was generally no written documentation of how the payout worked with tools. And so it was a good old boy thing. If your upline liked you, then you got a bigger tool bonus than if your upline did not like you. And that's just the way it was. And the accreditation process, besides toning down some of the extreme content, was to sort of normalize and have a written procedure on, you know, if you have certain attributes to your business, then you would get paid so much money. What we found out, I think it was from D again, was that they don't follow that. One of the things in LTD, one of the criteria was, if you are a blessing to your upline, now, you can interpret that so many different ways. I can easily interpret that as a good old boy system, and therefore there's been no progress, at least in LTD, in that regard. Now, I talked to Amway several years ago, probably one of the customer representatives, and I asked them about, you know, can I see the tool payout plan, which in my line of sponsorship, and I think in most of them, it starts out at platinum. And she said, no, you have to get there, then you can see it. I said, okay, so if I get to platinum, can I see the emerald, you know, the next step up? Can I see their pay plan? She said, no, even if you're a platinum, you can't see the emerald until you become an emerald. So it's still semi-secret. And also, it's really, to me, meaningless because of what Dee told us. It has no meaning to it as far as how much you get paid. And, you know, if you're liked, you get paid a lot. If you're not liked, not so much. So that's what I know about it. Did you have any particular questions, Dave?
No, I was just interested in with the fact that it being secret, when it's something that should be incentivized, right? If it's something legitimate that you want to run as a business and you want it to be a reward that people receive, which I know you've spoken about and said that it's not that, right? It's something that's unlocked when you get to this rank. But in the way that, say, in Primerica, where they do it, where you want to access those higher levels because you unlock those potentials for higher commissions, you would think that they would want that information to be readily available to help incentivize the race to that pin level, right? To do all the actions that would be needed in order to get to that point. So the fact that it's secret kind of tells you something, I feel.
Yeah, it does. It speaks very loudly. In fact, the only video that's on my YouTube channel is one of Andy Andrews, who was very, very obvious about what was going on. He allegedly pulled a letter out of his jacket, and I believe this was a legitimate letter he got from Amway. It was shortly before he got kicked out, so he was still trying to, you know, work things out with Amway at the time. It turned out it didn't work out. But in this letter, Amway said that only 2% of the people should be making money from tools, and the other 98% should not even be aware that there's an opportunity, which tells you that Amway is totally in on it. You can also listen to the Rich DeVos recording. It's also on my YouTube channel. It's just an audio where he clearly says, my lawyers tell me if you make more than 10% of your money from tools, we're going to get in trouble with the government. I'm such a nice guy. This is Rich DeVos speaking. My words, not his. I'm such a nice guy. I'm willing to go to 20%. Well, it's more like you know, 1,000% more and more in some cases. It's nowhere near 20%. And he even made threats, if you guys don't clean it up, we're going to take significant action. Well, nothing ever happened. And that was 1983, by the way, that he made those recordings. So, yeah, there's a lot of talk and not much action. But, that, you know, those are the things I do know as far as, you know, what's going on with that whole thing. Because you're right, Dave. If this was something that was in any other environment, you know, any other, like, sales company, that would be blasted everywhere to incentivize the salespeople to get to the higher levels. I mean, if you can unlock that kind of money, man, they would be shouting that from the rooftops, not keeping it secret. And so, you know, you realize very quickly that they don't want it out. Now, the internet has helped get it out there, but there's really not enough people talking about it. I'm one of the very few that really focuses on that issue. I wish there was more people, but all I can do is what I can do. So I would encourage others to talk about it because I do believe it's very significant, particularly with Amway, because it is, again, multiple times more from what they make in the Amway business. And as they fall back in pin level, now they keep wearing the same pin, right? If they were a diamond, they keep wearing a diamond pin, but they fall back to emerald or below, and you would think, oh, gee, now you're not making enough money to not have a job. but the tool profit is so lucrative, they don't have to worry about that, as long as they stay on the good side of their upline, of course. So anything more on that topic, Dave?
Not really. I think we can use that to kind of launch into the letters, though, because the letters, in addition to Noah Phillips mentioning gross versus net income for distributors, these letters also kind of touched on that as well, especially the one that was directed at the Better Business Bureau's guy who was heading up the DSSRC, Peter Marinello. Did you want to jump into that one?
Yeah, let's do that. And just for people to understand, the DSSRC is the Direct Selling Self-Regulatory Council, I think that's what it stands for. But anyway, it's an organization that has one foot in the DSA, which is the lobbyist, the Direct Selling Association, and one foot in the Better Business Bureau. So they kind of, you know, are in both organizations, or they you know, have one foot in one and one foot in the other sort of thing. But they were really created, I think it was in January of 2019, to try to address the issues of MLMs out of control. And they were trying to self-regulate versus having the FTC come in and regulate. So that was the intent of the DSSRC. And if you want to talk about that letter a little bit, Dave, and what the FTC said in response to the DSSRC's policies. I'll let you go ahead with that.
Sure. So, and a little bit of a prelude to this as well, also on the MLM conference website, I believe it was last year or the year before, Bonnie Patton had done a special presentation just covering TINA, so truthinadvertising.org, which is a nonprofit organization that sort of looks at the advertising space in general and will direct concerns to the FTC or a representative body within the government that would address some of the concerns that TINA would identify. But they were calling out some of the behaviors that they were noting on the DSSRC. So I don't know if that might have motivated this letter by the FTC. But nonetheless, Mr. Marinello, who is leading the Direct Selling Self-Regulatory Council, had several meetings with FTC officials over the years. The FTC was invited to present at some of their conferences on self-regulation and the legal frameworks that sort of support that. And the DSSRC has also published guidance in the past. And one of these guides that was talked about in, I think it was October, November of 2023, where Lois Greisman, who is the, I forget her title, the associate director for the Division of Marketing Practices, she's been with the FTC, I think, since 2006 in an official capacity, and then has also been sort of in the circles of FTCs, I think, as far back as 1995. She wrote this letter to Mr. Marinello and following the conversation she had had with him in fall of 2023, raising concerns that this guidance that the DSSRC published would not only not be beneficial for distributors, but might actually do harm for them. I think she states that in her letter, we believe the IDS guidance does much more harm than good for distributors. For distributors is something that I added there. But she is concerned that the estimates that are offered of income within this guidance and also during the presentation could never be truthful. She was claiming that there is the potential that you could publish guidance. She says, well, it is theoretically possible to make truthful, non-deceptive claims about substantial earnings. Doing so requires, at a minimum, a clear, prominent, and unavoidable presentation of the typical participant's revenue minus expenses, all of which must be substantiated. If that's the new guidance that the FTC is applying, I don't think I've seen it anywhere. This is a new norm for all MLMs to have to follow. Would you agree with that, Scott, or have you seen something that kind of represents that? It seemed like she didn't have any examples that she could offer where she was happy with the level of disclaimer.
Yeah, it's really, as far as I've been able to come across, it's only the second time. You know, I mentioned Commissioner Phillips, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago at the MLM conference, and mentioned, hey, we're starting to look at overhead costs, not just gross profit, but net profit. But after he said that, there was silence from the FTC all that time. So I guess they had some conversations, but they were more private. But I share the concerns of the FTC, because one of the things that I think the FTC pointed out, and it jumped out to me immediately because of my experience with Amway, is the DSSRC said that they would take into consideration required purchases of tools. Well, almost every MLM says you don't have to buy the tools. They're optional. But I can tell you a direct quote from my upline, and I think it's pretty common throughout other organizations in Amway and probably other MLMs, is, and they said this explicitly, by the way, this is not an interpretation or anything. I heard explicitly from stage on multiple occasions, the tools are optional, but so is success. Now, you don't have to be a genius to understand what that means. And I can also tell you, when I found out about the tool scam in 2005, and I wrote a very short email to my upline platinum, I didn't complain. I didn't, you know, call them any names. I didn't say anything derogatory. I just said, please take me off of standing order tools. I went literally overnight from best buddy to complete ignoring. And so if you call that optional, it's optional. But everyone knows, particularly if I had been a new distributor, right? If I had been a new IBO in Amway, I would have no clue what to do. At that point, I had been in for a dozen years, so I had a pretty good idea of what was going on, you know, as far as how to run the business. But if you came in new and you said, I'm not going to participate in tools, and then you got ignored, you wouldn't know where to start. You wouldn't know anything. And you would be at such a disadvantage to everybody else. It's not even funny. Here's what I would say if I was the FTC talking to the DSSRC. I would say, here's what you're going to do. You're going to calculate what is being recommended to the distributors as far as tool purchases. If they recommend a certain level of tool consumption, then that is what goes into the calculation. That way, you have the proper incentives set up. As far as, now you have to police these things. Don't get me wrong. You know, these people are really good liars, and so you still have to be able to audit and check and those kinds of things. And I made a suggestion back in May of 2022 when the FTC was looking for input on earnings claims and product claims, and I thought that what Washington State did with LuLaRoe was very good. What they got LuLaRoe to do, and this is a settlement, so LuLaRoe agreed to it, but it's only in the state of Washington. It's not country, the whole country. But they agreed to give the attorney general in Washington State contact information for all their distributors. Now, that's good from not so much the standpoint of the distributors, but most distributors become former distributors in less than a year. But they still have the contact information. And so the attorney general can call all these people after they quit and say, okay, what were you really being taught? You know, we know you weren't going to tell us the truth while you were a distributor because, you know, you were on the other team. But now that you lost a bunch of money and you know, whatever happened to you and you quit, what were they teaching? What was being taught? You know, were you being taught to do retail sales? Were you being taught to consume tools ad infinitum? Those are the kind of things that would really be helpful, and the FTC doesn't even have to do the work, right? TINA.org would be happy to do it. They could assign that to the DSSRC. I'm sure there's other law firms out there that could do the work, that would be willing to do that pro bono, just to help out the MLM industry. And that would be the way that the FTC could get the job done. And yet, because of what Peter mentioned earlier, they have a big smorgasbord of things they're responsible for. MLM is just one little slice of that. But that would be a way that they could actually, you know, share the load. They wouldn't have to do all that work to see what's really going on. They could just insist that the MLMs give them, you know, the contact information for their distributors, and then, you know, just wait a few months, start calling some of these people and see which one of them are now former distributors, and see what the answers are. I believe the answers would be much more truthful if they were former distributors than if they were current distributors. But anyway, that's my take. And what I would do, Dave, as far as those overhead costs, but also part of that income disclosure statement must include the amount of profit being made on the tools, because you're looking at, you know, through a telescope or a microscope, but you're looking through only one end. You got to turn that thing around and look at both ends. You know, not only how much money is being put into the system by the distributors, but how much profit is coming out. And that needs to be disclosed as part of the income disclosure so that people can see what they're getting into, so they can see what their upline's incentives are. Otherwise, they're flying blind. But that's my take on that DSSRC. And I have to say also, the DSSRC has turned in about, I think, 18 to 20, my last count, examples of really, really extreme misbehavior on different MLMs. And they're mostly the smaller ones. I don't think that's an accident. I think that they know where their bread is buttered, you know, the Herbalife and the Amways. So they're not going to go after the big guys. They're going to go after the little guys, and they're going to come up with these violations and turn them over to the FTC, which is their charter. That's what they're supposed to do. But I haven't seen any of these companies been pursued by the FTC, at least publicly. They might be doing it privately. But even that, to me, is wrong, because the FTC should be making public what they're doing. They're not responsible to the MLMs. They're responsible to the citizens. And if they're looking into a company because the DSSRC said, hey, this company's really screwing up, then the FTC should be pretty much immediately announcing, yes, this looks like it's real. We're investigating. Stay tuned. But it's been, I think, at least, well, gosh, since they've been around since 2019, yes, the DSSRC, you know, we're talking probably 4 or 5 years of silence now for some of these companies, and I think that's wrong. So the whole environment, you know, whether it be the DSSRC, the FTC, the MLMs, it's all very dysfunctional. I mean, every organization I just mentioned has problems, and you know, none of them are really doing what they're supposed to do, none of them. And you know, there needs to be change, you know, amongst all of them, whether it's the DSSRC, the DSA, the FTC, the MLMs, everybody. That's how I see it. So I'll let you make any more comments. And Peter, you can chime in here too if you'd like.
I do have a bit of a question for Peter.
Yep.
In just a moment. I did want to highlight the statement that Griesman did right related to the tools. She did say, if it is gross, as I suspect, so she's assuming that the $25 per week that Marinello had suggested would substantiate a modest income for individuals, which they went back and forth on that a little bit, I suppose. And Griesman's position on that is, although it might help some people within America with that $25 per week, or if it was 50 and it made a total of 100 within a month, 200 within a month, it would still be something that might affect that person, but it might not qualify as modest or what was the other term that we use, supplemental for their income. She's saying if that's gross, as she suspects, then there's a further problem with this claim. It does not account for expenses such as costs for product purchases, travel for conferences, tools or services, and training. So your tools or services and training, I assume, Scott, would that be enough to substantiate your concerns, or there should be more?
Yeah, well, I think that anytime you make an income claim, it should take into account the overhead. I mean, there's no business in the world, I'm talking non-MLM here, that looks at gross profit. You know, they look at net profit. They don't care how much money they brought in the door. They want to look at the difference between what they brought in and how much it costs to bring that in. Because if you make $1,000, let's say, a month in an MLM, but it cost you $2,000 to make it, you didn't make $1,000. You lost $1,000. And that's just MLM math. They don't like talking about the overhead costs, but that's real. Now, I think if it was $50 net, that would be a modest income. And I think Lois had a problem with that, even if it was a net income. I don't. I think $50, what was it, $50 a week or $25 a week, that is modest income, and it's real. I mean, there's a lot of people even in this country where $25 a week would make a difference. They're really pinching pennies. And if they made $25 a week net income, that would really help out some things. And I think it's, you know, just not right to say $25 does not count as a modest income, because in my mind it does. Now it's very modest, but it's still modest. So, but it needs to include the overhead costs.
And I think that kind of points to the difficulty that a lot of the FTC has when going after these pyramid scheme cases. They've said in the past, at least on conferences and in talks with them, that it's a very fact-intensive case to bring. You have to not only show that all the policies might support that, but in the absence of the policies necessarily reflecting how it incentivizes recruitment to such a substantial degree through practice of distributors that it's done. And even in those cases, they don't necessarily get to win. Like in the Niora case, they couldn't attach brand partners, which is what Niora calls their distributors, as agents of the company. So any actions that were done by those brand partners could then not reflect poorly on the company, which the FTC was bringing to trial. So there are those issues. It seems within the most recent cases that were brought forward, and Peter, you might have more information than I do about this, but it seems like they relied on insider information that gave the FTC the go-ahead because they felt they had enough of the facts needed to present the pyramid scheme case. I might be wrong about that, but in both Niora and Success by Health, it seemed like they had someone at least that tipped them off with enough data that they felt that they could go ahead and make the claim.
Yeah, I can comment on Niora. I know that Peter knows a lot about Success by Health, but in the Niora case, and we did two entire shows on the Niora decision, the judge's decision. It was like 56 pages. And what jumped out to me, Dave, was, and Peter and I have been talking about this for as long as it's been going on, as far as the disagreement between Niora and the FTC, I think it's been at least 3 or 4 years, you know, since this whole thing started. And the whole thing to me was, not the whole thing, but the biggest thing. The biggest thing to me was that the FTC was saying, Niora, you have 1% retail sales. And Niora said, no, we have like 70 or 80% retail sales. And I can remember every time it came up, you know, in conversation on this show over the past 3 or 4 years, I said, somebody is really wrong here. There's no way there can be this much of a divergence between one side and the other side. There's just no way you can go from 1 to 70 or 80%. It makes no sense. You know, someone is really screwed up here. Well, it turns out, according to the judge, and I believe her, what happened was that the FTC saw that for Niora, if you paid full retail price for the products, which 1% of the customers did, okay, they paid full retail cost, they were labeled by Niora as retail customers. They also had preferred customers who got a discount. I think they paid like $20 a year, and as long as you know you buy a decent amount of products, you can pay back that $20 a year pretty quickly. You know, if you were a decent customer, that's a good deal, because you got a discount and then you recoup your 20 and then you actually save more. So it just made sense to that 99% of the customers. But the FTC and all their wisdom decided that only the customers that were labeled as retail customers were actually retail customers. But everyone knows, or everyone should know, that a preferred customer is just as much of a retail customer as a retail customer. But the FTC blew that completely. And so I'm convinced they don't know what they're doing because they lost that case in spades. I mean, they had 5 charges. They were 0-5. Now, they were at a little bit of a disadvantage because they sued Niora before that 9-0 decision we talked about. And the rules changed midway, and the lawsuit was already in place. So one of the things that Niora was able to do was change their policies and change their rules and, you know, basically clean house internally between the time they got sued and it went to trial. And because of the new Supreme Court ruling, the only thing that the FTC could do was hold Niora accountable for things that they were currently doing or about to do. If they did them in the past, it no longer counted. And so it put the FTC a little bit of a disadvantage because New York cleaned up their act. They said, we're not doing that. And the judge, you know, was bound obviously by the Supreme Court. And so the judge said, yeah, they're not doing it. And it doesn't look like they're about to do it. So, you know, not guilty, basically. And so, you know, they kind of, I won't say cheat, but they took advantage of the circumstances, put it that way. And they were able to win, quote unquote, for that reason as well. They just happened to get lucky with the timing. And so that's kind of my take on the Niora case. I think the FTC just blew it. And the judge made that very clear. In that 56-page decision that basically she said over and over again, hey, FTC, you brought nothing to the table. The Niora brought very thin evidence to the table. You know, now, she didn't say these words exactly, but if you read the decision, I think you would come away with this conclusion. She said that, you know, they didn't bring much to the table, Niora, but since the FTC didn't bring anything, I have to find in favor of Niora. I'm bound to do that. This is a civil case. You know, it's 50.001% of the weight of the evidence. I have to find in that side's favor. And so I had to find in Niora's favor. That's just, you know, because the FTC really didn't bring anything to the table. And so, you know, that's just part of what happened there. Any comments on that, Dave?
I would agree with you. I think that the FTC showed up possibly thinking that they could argue a certain case in that trial, and they lost it on several accounts. I think that their assumptions with the brand partners, I think, was their undoing, the fact that they couldn't get the court to recognize the assumptions that Stacey Bosley was using to conduct her analysis. My understanding is that the FTC had sort of given Stacey two assumptions to work with, and then Stacey had sort of applied a concept within Burn Lounge to develop her third, which was that all brand partners who had signed up would only be purchasing products on the basis of the rewards they would receive for those products, and were not making those decisions as ultimate users of those products. So it's frustrating that they went to that extent. I think that it might indicate sort of where the FTC is allocating its priorities in terms of its resources. Hopefully it's not a signal for sort of how they're going to approach future cases as well. I imagine that they're going to be reticent to bring any further trials, especially after these letters, right? These letters almost offer a reset in terms of, we're going to give all MLMs a chance to reallocate their priorities, and then we'll check back in like 5 years' time, or I don't know how long it's going to be, and we'll see if you're still doing these things, and then maybe we can bring some of these cases against you, because it seems like with this clarification, it also is giving the MLMs like a clean slate to kind of work from, and then anything that's happened prior to this point in terms of concerns, it's as if the FTC is kind of beholden to not being able to hold them responsible for it, because they're sort of acknowledging that there's been a lack of clear guidance within the marketplace.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think you're right, Dave. I think it's going to be years. I know when the first round of the business opportunity rule came around in 2006, it took, I think, 5 or 6 years for the final decision to come out. And we started just 2 years ago with the earnings claims and income claims. And there really hasn't been anything since coming out from the FTC as far as updates on that. I hope they have hearings. I'm going to insist on a hearing. That's something that I'm disappointed in myself a little bit because they asked me a few years into the business opportunity rule years ago, do you need to have a hearing? And their position was, we're only going to have a hearing if you're going to bring new stuff to the table. If you've already given us the input, that's not the basis of a hearing. And I said, well, I really pretty much said everything the first time around. But knowing now that they didn't understand it, I am going to insist on a hearing, because I would again say, I don't think you guys understand my input. You know, I just told you about the tool scam, and I became literally a footnote in the Federal Register with no other action. You know, here's this blatant scam, and you guys put it in a footnote in the Federal Register. You know, basically, hey, this guy Johnson says something about a bunch of money being made on tools. And that was it. It was entirely inadequate. When it comes up again, I'm going to insist on a hearing, because I don't believe they understand it. And then the Aura is a very good example. And it's not like they're new to this game, right? They have the Vima and Herbalife settlements. They have AdvoCare. In 2019, they forced AdvoCare to drop the MLM pay plan and go to direct sales. You know, there's no upline, no downline. Every distributor is connected directly to the company. The money you make is what you can sell. They had all these, you know, victories in their pocket, and then they go to New York and just totally blow it. It's amazing to me how they can have all that, you know, experience, and maybe the lawyers that did Neora had no clue about those things, which is a problem in of itself too, right? Because you would think that more experienced people around the FTC would give them a heads up. Hey, here's a template, you know, see how much of this applies to Neora, versus just assuming that it did. Now, one thing I found very suspicious, Dave, having been in Amway, is that, and this is part of the judge's decision, apparently 30%, almost one-third of the new distributors in Neora were formerly preferred customers. And I found that really odd because that is so rare in Amway and probably most other MLMs that you would go from a preferred customer to a distributor. And the reason they were doing it, according to Neora, was that distributors got an even larger discount on the products. And so if they signed up as a distributor, they could get an even larger discount. But now you're muddying the waters between a distributor and a customer. I don't think that should be allowed. I think that was a missed opportunity for the FTC to say, hey, judge, you can't have a bigger discount for a distributor because now we don't know what their intent is in buying the products. And you need to have that. You need to have a definite line between a distributor and a customer because one of the things that happened in course of the lawsuit, this is in the footnotes, I think, of Neora, was the question was asked of Bosley, well, what if there was a preferred customer that bought a certain amount of products and then they decided to become a distributor and they bought the same amount of products? Would you consider that their incentive completely changed? And she said yes. I mean, she lost it right there. She lost her argument because there's no way you can make sense of that. If they did not increase the amount of purchases, how can you say they went from I like the products to I want to go to a higher level? You can't. That makes no sense. They blew it and she blew it big time. I can't believe that the FTC considers her an expert. I hope they don't anymore. There were several things in that lawsuit that were amazing to me. And that 30% of new distributors is very suspicious. I think there's more going on there. I don't know what, but I think there's more going on as far as people being misled. Go ahead, Dave.
If I were to hazard a guess, I would say that I mean, as a distributor, you need a certain number of orders each month in order to qualify for certain rewards. I believe in the compensation plan, I went over it at least 2 or 3 years ago now, but there were rewards offered on the basis of your customer allocation under you. And I would assume what's happening there, which we know happens across MLMs, is that there's ghost accounts or accounts that are created under your own portfolio, and at some point there might be an incentive to allocate more distributors under you in order to unlock other bonuses or rewards, right? So that shift might be happening, at least in some of those cases, because the incentives would sort of permit that. And unfortunately, unless you're looking at shipping addresses for goods or some other layer that indicates that all of this is going to sort of one household, it's hard to prove that case. It would be interesting to look at that data and see whether or not that would be shown.
Yeah, and even if you do that, I know that people are being taught in Amway. I was not. I just happened not to be a part of that particular technique, but we've had the guests on this show that said, here's what we were taught to do. You find a nearby friend or relative, you use their address, you use their name, you use their credit card, their phone number, their email, their everything. You make an order under all that information, and then you go over there with a check in your hand, and you take the products, you give them the check, and everything looks great. And that's why you have to talk to these former distributors to see what they were being taught, because that's how sophisticated these people are in coming up with fake customers. Now, I had two theories as far as Neora. One was because they want customers, they're being taught to bring people in as customers with a discount and then later telling them, hey, you can get an even bigger discount if you're a distributor. In the meantime, they're creating more customers so they can keep their customer count up. Or they're actually being blatant about it and saying, look, we need to make you a customer first because we need customers. And then in a couple months or whatever it is, then you can become a distributor and do the same thing with new quote-unquote customers. So they're either kind of delaying telling them there's a bigger discount, or they're telling them up front, look, because I think this is what's going on in the UK with Amway, you know, because you have to have like 250 or 300 bucks of or pounds over there of retail sales before you can recruit anybody in the UK only. I think that's what they're doing. I think they're saying, go find yourself someone that wants to sign up and say, don't sign up yet. You know, buy some products from me as a customer, then you can sign up. And then we'll help you also find new distributors that'll, you know, be a temporary customer. I think that's how they're getting around it, because I just happen to know how they think. You know, they're just, you know, that's how they are. So anyway, I don't know what's going on, but I think it's very fishy that it's 30%, very fishy. I would put a typical percentage of that happening in any other MLM is less than 1%. That's my guess, educated guess.
I'm sure we have to wrap up soon, so I don't want to force Peter to mention about Success by Health, but I suppose in the Neora case alone, you could get
sure.
to.
Well, we can have you come.
Go ahead.
We can have you come back whenever you want. You know, we can obviously with someone like yourself, Dave. There's a lot of information here, so we can have another radio show. So I could talk about it, Success by Health, but I don't want to take up too much more of our time. We have about 12 minutes left.
Okay.
But if you want me to touch on it, I can.
Yeah.
So I'll give you the.
You can probably.
I'll give you the. No more than 3 minutes synopsis. So.
Sure, that would be great.
Success by Health. So I know a lot about this because I saw the evolution of Success by Health, started by Jay Nolan, as it was generated from him being a consultant, if you will, or trainer, out of a different network marketing company, and he kind of moved over to have a coffee company. And Success by Health started off mostly with coffee. So Jay was we're going to call it a layup or lay down or however you want to call it, an easy mark for the FTC. Previously, so they were looking for an easy win, and all you had to do is look around the industry and say, okay, I need somebody unsophisticated. I need all the money in one place and somebody that's going to be easy to get so we can easily win. Jay Nolan had a previous, let's call it arrest. I'm going to use that as a term. It's not really what happened, but he had a previous blemish with the FTC where he already had a warning. So it's kind of like you go to a guy who's been arrested before and you look for a parole violation, and that's easy to find because he just does – if he stays in the same industry, it's going to be easy to find. So that was number one. Number two, he had a disgruntled employee who was a leading distributor who he brought over from that previous network marketing company when he started his own. And what happened was that disgruntled employee wound up getting his downline. On his way out the door, he said to Jay Nolan, the very last thing I do, I will shut you down. So you had a pissed off, disgruntled employee, leading distributor, that went to file about 27 complaints to the FTC all at one time. So there's some FTC guy sitting there is like, holy crap, this is like better than Christmas. We have a previous offender. We have 27 different complaints. And if for those people that wonder, how many complaints does it take for the FTC? Well, in Success by Health, the number is 27. So the number was 27, and they were an easy mark. So an unsophisticated owner, somebody who's loose all over the place, commingled funds all over the place, and he wound up hiring some, let's call them, I don't know, not-so-good lawyers. So lawyers of questionable integrity, meaning they were probably interested in their pockets more than they were interested in Jay Nolan's. And it was an easy win. And you also had a favorable judge. So a favorable judge who said, listen, we don't care that you have 750 affidavits from people that love your company and love your product and would buy their product anyway. We don't care that somebody would buy all the products anyway. We just say that there's no retail want of having your product, and that's not necessarily true, but it was totally messed up, and Stacey Bosley manipulated those. The reality was is that they said there was no retail for the product, which was not true. They said that this guy was a repeat offender, which he probably was, and he didn't know how to, he didn't understand claims. So he went out there and talked about how you're going to get rich and made a couple of comments on a webinar like, yeah, sure, this is a pyramid. We're running a scam. And all of that stuff taken out of context. So FTC looked at Success by Health as being a layup. It was a lay down. It was a closed deal before you even got started. And that set the tone, I think, for why they were hoping they were going to win the Neora case, because after coming off like a slam dunk with Success by Health, I really think they held back the Neora decision to be able to parlay off that win, and they were shocked, the FTC, when they got their, you know, their fanny spanked by the judge, who wasn't going for any of the hocus pocus stuff that the Stacey Bosley was trying to pull, and a whole bunch of other things were going on with New York, because they had better lawyers and a little bit better of a roadmap of what they had to prove. So I'm going to be I'm done with my Success by Health, because I told her I was only going to take about 3 minutes. But those cases were so opposite. So opposite, and we could talk more about that stuff a little bit later on. But next. Oh, and I'm just gonna say one thing real quick. This whole mess of MLM. Remember, I came in as an outsider, so I was in direct sales before. I come into MLM, I'm like listening to the pitches of these MLM people. I'm like, you know, you guys are friggin' lying about a lot of stuff. I mean, you're overhyping everything. I mean, no one's making the kind of money that you're referencing on a massive scale. You're giving all of these false hopes. This is not the way this works. Why don't you people just tell the truth? And if you just told the truth, you wouldn't have any of these issues. And I think that is the root of most of the problems. Like Scott talks about, like if you just had retail sales and you stopped the tool scam, that would eliminate a lot of the problems. Well, if MLMers would just redefine the mission statement behind MLM to be like, you know, this could be a pretty big part-time gig for you. You might be able to learn about some really cool products, and you might be able to get some discounts on your own. And if you're into building teams, you'll make a little bit of money on a lot of people. And if you make a little bit of money on a lot of people, you can make a lot of money. But the answer is most of you will just be those people that save on some products, make a little bit part-time, probably learn a lot more about your product. If you're taking advantage of health and nutrition, you might live a little longer or a little bit healthier. If you're dealing with financial services, you might learn something about banking or finances or spending your money. And if you're in a technology-driven company, you might learn a little bit about technology. But if they just change their story and wouldn't stop friggin' combination of lying or embellishing or hyperventilating, we wouldn't have a lot of the problems that we have in MLM. So I'm done with my portion of this. So I'll let you comment on any of that stuff, Dave.
Yeah, I think that many of these letters that are being sent out, they're dealing with some of the case findings and the momentum that the DSA is sort of pushing things forward with. But I think what you're talking about, Peter, is really sort of what we see on the ground level looking up, like at the people who are within MLM, and there needs to be some sort of promise that's offered to those to dedicate their time to something new, right? Because you know that you might be giving up your time. I know Mariano, in terms of his approach to it, is very much in line with what you were saying. I think he usually uses the term hobby to explain MLM. But I think in practice, what we see with a lot of these MLMs is that it needs to be something more to attract the attention that people want. Because I think that even though the reality is that most people are not making money, there's a number of people that want to make a lot of money. And in order to get there, you need a huge distributor base below you that is either regularly purchasing the product that you get the rewards for or has a large retail base underneath them. So it's very hard to prevent that from happening, I feel.
Right. So let me share with you what's starting to happen in some of the situations that I deal with. What I'm finding is the distributors are saying to themselves, you know what? I make more. If somebody's not going to be recruiting somebody, I make more when I sponsor them as a customer. And if they like the product after a couple of months and they want to become a distributor, I'll let them be a distributor. But I make less money when they're a distributor. I make more money when they're a customer. So there's a lot of MLMs, whether we hear about it or not, that are taking that approach on their own. They're looking at their own compensation and saying, you know what? If this guy didn't become a distributor, I'd make more money if he bought retail for me. And we're seeing a little bit of that starting to take root, and I think maybe some of the compliance that's happening. Now, I do want to mention this, David. I don't know if I sent this to you, but I know I sent it to Scott. There's an online marketer. His name is A-N-I-K Single, S-I-N-G-A-L. He was spanked real hard by the FTC, real hard, and he came out with his own channel called Don't Say That. So if you go search for that, you'll see he tells his FTC story about income claims and about business practices and how now he's like an evangelist for compliance, where before he said he didn't realize all the things he was doing wrong. He thought he was doing things right, meaning like he's a good guy building a big practice. I'm not so sure if that's true. But the reality is that he has a lot of education about compliance. So he might be something to take a look at as well. So I'm not endorsing anything that he's saying. I'm just saying bringing people to awareness that the FTC is on the mark and on the march when it comes to income claims, for sure, whether it's for MLM or it's the online marketers, but they are looking out. So back to you.
Yes, no, I think it will be interesting to see what the FTC does. It seems that they're also hesitant, although they've offered warnings on their penalty offense authority, which I think is up to like $50,000 per violation now with inflation from back to his first pass. So I don't know if they'll go after individual distributors with that or not, but I know that they've also, like in recent years, they've had the DOJ go after some distributors for COVID claims. So I think that even though the FTC might not go after specific companies for a while now because of their recent wounds in court, it doesn't mean that they won't necessarily find other actions to take against offenses.
Yeah, I see them being the FTC is pretty much inert. You know, they're all talk. There's not very much action. And we're talking literally, this is not an exaggeration. Every single year in the United States alone, there's millions of new people who are being scammed by MLMs. Now, most of them don't last for more than a year. Most of them don't lose a lot of money. But they're all getting involved in either an illegal pyramid or an illegal pyramid plus a RICO fraud. And for the FTC to just sort of back down and say, well, we got to regroup again for another 5 years, it, to me, is ridiculous because they've been doing this since around 1975. We got to get you back here, Dave, because the whole Costcott thing is amazing. I don't know if you've ever read that entire decision, the Costcott decision, but I read it a few months ago. And it just blew me away on how extreme of an example. In fact, I think it's the most extreme example of an MLM doing things wrong. And yet it's the basis for how the FTC goes after MLMs. And to me, it's totally nuts on using a company that didn't even have products for like a year. And then when they did have products, because they were based on mink oil, which was in short supply, they had short supplies of products. And so the whole Costcott decision is basically based on an MLM with no products. and that's what the FTC has been banking on all these years ever since. And to me, it's time to get off of that. It's time to get on to retail sales. Okay, you got to have free market demand for the products. Costcott, there was no free market demand because there was no products. It was ridiculous. And yet that's how that judge, the framework of that judge's decision was that environment. And companies don't charge because they were charging $5,000, you know, for a new distributor. If you wanted to get the good deal, you would pay $5,000. Well, that's almost $30,000 in today's dollars. Can you imagine having to pay $30,000 just to join an MLM to get, you know, benefits of discounts and all that kind of stuff? Companies aren't doing that anymore. they're charging little to nothing to join, but then there's no retail sales on an ongoing basis. That's the problem. It's not the fact that you're getting paid to join, because most MLMs don't do that anymore. And most of them are very vocal about it. You know, Amway says you don't make one penny when someone signs up. And that's true. However, the first time they buy a product, whether it's the starter kit or ongoing purchases, you do make money. And so, again, they're telling a part of the truth, but they're not telling the whole story. And the FTC is clueless, in my opinion, as far as what to focus on. They need to focus on retail sales. Forget all this other stuff, because it's just not an issue. And think about this. What's the one topic that MLMs hardly ever talk about? Retail sales. There's your clue. When they don't talk about it, that's what you have to focus on. But if you're not aware of it, then you're not going to focus on it. But once you're aware of it, it's like, oh, yeah, they really don't mention retail sales very much. That's interesting. So it's just amazing to me.
But before we wrap this up, I have a quick question for Dave. So it may be a quick question for me, but you could take as much time as you want, Dave, on this answer.
Sure.
The MLM conference. So for those people that are listening in, if you go to MLMconference.com, you can register for free. It's really not an MLM conference. It's really an anti-MLM conference. But it's, you know, I believe in gathering as much information as you can. So I'm sure that I may not agree with a lot of the stuff.
Peter, are you still there? It went quiet on me. Are you there, Dave?
I am here, but I lost Peter.
Yeah, we don't hear you, Peter. I don't know if you're still talking. Dave and I can hear each other, but you went quiet.
I think the platform might have cut him off. He might be joining us in a few moments, but I can just sort of say, with the MLM conference coming up, I know that they have it planned. There's a social media advocacy group that's going to happen on the last day, so if you don't really want to hear from the anti-MLM content creators, most of the other exercises that are happening throughout the conference, I believe it's mostly, there's a panel of journalists, a number of academics that are presenting some of their data that they've collected. I don't believe Stacey Bosley is going to be there. They're bringing on some other academics, as well as Bill Keith will be there. I know Peter Vandernat, who is a retired economist with the FTC, he will be there to talk about his takeaways from the NIORA decision. So there'll be some interesting thoughts shared, even though they might not be all agreeable with your positions. It'll still be interesting to sort of hear from some of these people in terms of what their takeaways are, even on some of the conversations we had here today.
Well, I'm very much looking.
Can you hear me again?
We can hear you now. Yeah, we can hear you now.
Okay.
You were quiet
for
the last couple minutes. That's okay.
Yeah, I don't know what happened. I think I leaned back and something might have happened with my headset. But anyway, the question I had for Dave is, there was a big push by some of the social media people about a company called On Passive, Ash Musfarov's company that, you know, was, you know, something that never really actually, they never pulled the trigger. And shortly after that, the SEC went after them. So right now, Ash is going through the trials, if you will, with the SEC. There's a couple of people that were going after Transact Card as far as the anti-MLMers and Finmore. And there's a couple of the anti-MLMers that are really going after Finmore and Transact basically just shut down for all intents and purposes. And now there's some of the founders, Nilo Life, and there's a couple of anti-MLMers that are really going after Nilo Life. And Nilo Life is probably going to be showcased on this MLM conference if it's up to some of these anti-MLMers doing their social media thing. Do you have any feedback on that at all, if you think that maybe that is going to make the FTC look at these companies or not?
I know that reports have been filed on all three of those companies, and I know that people who have lost out from the first two that you mentioned, Transact and Finmore, they have filed their own reports with the FTC. So I know it's at least in the system, whether it's on their radar or not, I'm not sure. It seems like there's some response that's taken within the government when this is brought to their attention. I don't know whether or not on passive was really sort of placed on the SEC radar because of the MLM conference or not. I don't know. You'd have to ask Professor Keith whether or not they were even in attendance at the event. But yeah, I think it's reasonable to assume that NeoLife is going to be brought up given the presence of Julie Anderson or I believe Roberta Blevins isn't speaking, but she will be there in the background sort of helping to support. So I imagine there will be some attention brought to those companies and NeoLife in terms of where it currently stands in its form, it does seem very similar to the Costcut sense where there's not really a product being offered yet. I think that there's a travel platform that's been somewhat launched. There's other promises of future products coming out, but again, in a form that's kind of straddling between where OnPassive is and some other MLMs that are in operation. I think Nilo is kind of found in the middle of that. So it'll be interesting to see whether or not there's any action taken on that and whether plays anything.
Those gals went after OnPassive like with a vengeance. I mean, they were like that was their panel and they went after him.
Numerous.
And they were good at, by the way, they were good at what they did. And and then all of a sudden, a couple of months later, SEC is after them. And, you know, I think Ash is clueless. He thinks he's doing the right thing and he thinks he's going to be able to make it. And I think he's totally clueless because, oh, my gosh, I watched some of their videos and I'm like, oh, my gosh, these guys are just high-fiving each other when they're going through this. And the SEC is different from the FTC, but that's where they got them because they basically made it like it was an investment. So I'm just kind of asking for your opinion. Okay.
Yeah.
So, Scott, I'll let you wrap it up however you want. And the MLM conference, I think, is at the end of this month, end of April, beginning part of May. You'd have to check it out yourselves. It's usually a two-day thing. It's virtual. And then a couple of weeks later, they have the replays. So catch as much of it live as you can if you're interested, and catch the replays when you're done, and you can catch last year's and the previous year stuff as well and see day two. So, Scott, I'll let you wrap it up.
Yeah, sounds good. It's May. Yeah, thanks, Dave. And I think it's May 2nd and 3rd. So, yeah, go to MLMconference.com. I'm really looking forward to Peter Vandernat's presentation because my understanding from reading the outline of the conference is he's going to basically describe how the FTC was cheated in that Neora lawsuit, which really puzzles me because just a few years ago, and I think he wrote an article on TINA.org, and this has been a few years, not a large number of years, but he made the comment that more and more he's convinced about the primacy of retail sales, which, you know, is my mantra. And I'm thinking, hey, someone's finally getting it. But now how is he going to go to this MLM conference and argue that the FTC was cheated when the evidence was that Neora had plenty of retail sales? So I'm really looking forward to that on what his take is, because I see a conflict there between those two ideas that he's put out. So we'll see. We'll see what he has to say. But yeah, I do want to thank Dave for being here, and Dave, we'll have you back again because, you know, we didn't even touch on the DSA letter. That was the other big one that was amazing that the FTC no longer believes that or they made the comment. I won't spoil it. We'll save the DSA later for another session. It was amazing, truly amazing. But anyway, again, Dave, thank you. And we just appreciate the, you know, the breadth of ideas and perspectives and all that kind of thing. And we'll see you again next Saturday, Peter.
And Dave, do you want to give out any contact information as far as like Twitter stuff or anything else that you might have as far as social media if you want?
Sure. You can find me at Dave G, V-A-U-G-H-A-N, Dave G Vaughn on Instagram. That's probably the easiest part. And then you can redirect to all of my other places. Thank you both for having me on again. And yes, happy to return.
Yep. Thanks for being here. Thanks, everyone. All right. Bye for now.
You've been listening to Building Fortunes Radio on buildingfortunesradio.com. Thanks for listening. Be sure to check us out every Friday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time for the designated Building Fortunes Radio segment with Peter Mingle. Be sure to check out the buildingfortunesradio.com website for our featured segments. It's been our privilege to have you listen in. At Building Fortunes Radio, we wish you the success you deserve and are willing to work for. So spread the word, tell a friend, join our newsletter, and go make a difference in your world.